people watching all smiled at one another when my father mentioned the Gettysburg Address. I whispered to my brother, "What happened?" "Anti-Semitism," he whispered back. From where we were standing, we saw the two policemen when they arrived on their motorcycles. We watched them cut their engines and come into the hotel. One of them stationed himself just inside the door where he could keep an eye on everybody while the other approached the front desk and beckoned the manager over to where the two of them could speak confidentially. "Officer," my father said. The policeman spun around and said, "I can attend to only one party to a dispute at a time, sir," and resumed talking with the manager, his chin cupped thoughtfully in one hand. My father turned to us. "Got to be done, boys." To my mother, he said, "There's nothing to worry about." Having finished his discussion with the manager, the policeman now came around to talk to my father. He didn't smile as he had intermittently while standing and listening to the manager, but he spoke nonetheless without a trace of anger and in a tone that seemed friendly at first. "What's the problem, Roth?" "We sent a deposit for a room at this hotel for 3 nights. We received a letter confirming everything. My wife has the paperwork in our bags. We get here today, we register, we occupy the room and unpack, we go out to sightsee, and when we come back, we're evicted because the room was reserved for somebody else." "And the problem?" the cop asked. "We're a family of four, officer. We drove all the way from New Jersey. You can't just throw us into the street." "But," said the cop, "if somebody else reserves a room..." "But there is nobody else, and if there was, why should we take a backseat to them?" "But the manager returned your deposit. He even packed up your belongings for you. Officer, you're not understanding me. Why should our reservation take a backseat to theirs? I was with my family at the Lincoln Memorial. They have the Gettysburg Address up on the wall. You know what the words are that are written there? All men are created equal." "But that doesn't mean all hotel reservations are created equal." The policeman's voice carried to the bystanders at the edge of the lobby. Unable any longer to control themselves, some of them laughed aloud. My mother left Sandy and me standing alone in order to step forward now and intervene. She had been waiting for a moment when she wouldn't make things worse and, despite her rapid breathing, seemed to believe this was it. "Dear, let's just go," she beseeched my father. Mr. Taylor found us a room nearby. "No," my father cried, and he threw off the hand with which she had tried to snatch his arm. "This policeman knows why we were evicted. He knows, the manager knows, everybody in this lobby knows." "I think you ought to listen to your wife," the cop said. "I think you ought to do what she tells you, Roth. Leave the premises." Jerking his head in the direction of the door, he said, "And before you wear out my patience." There was more resistance in my father, but there was still some sanity in him as well, and he was able to understand that his argument had run out of interest to anyone other than himself. We left the hotel with everybody watching us. The only one to speak was the other cop. From where he'd stationed himself just beside the potted plant in the entranceway, he nodded amiably and, as we approached, put a hand out to muss my hair. "How you doing, young fella?" "Good," I replied. "What do you got there?" "My stamps," I said, but just kept going before he could ask to see my collection, and I had to show it to him to avoid arrest. Mr. Taylor was waiting on the sidewalk outside. My father said to him, "That has never happened to me before in my life. I'm out among people all the time, people from all backgrounds, from all walks of life, and never..." "The Douglas has changed hands," Mr. Taylor said. "This is a new ownership." "But we had friends who stayed there and were 100% satisfied," my mother told him. "Well, Mrs. Roth, it's changed hands. But I've got you a room at the Evergreen, and everything is going to work out fine." Just then, there was the loud roar of a low-flying plane passing over Washington. Down the street where some people were out walking, they stopped, and one of the men raised his arms to the sky as though, in June, it had begun to snow. Sandy, who could recognize just about anything flying from its silhouette, knowledgeable Sandy pointed and cried, "It's the Lockheed Interceptor." "It's President Lindbergh," Mr. Taylor explained. "Every afternoon about this time, he takes a little spin along the Potomac, flies up to the Alleghenies, then down along the Blue Ridge Mountains, and on out to the Chesapeake Bay. People look forward to it." "It's the world's fastest plane," my brother said. The German's Messerschmitt 110 flies 365 miles an hour. The Interceptor flies 500 miles an hour. It can outmaneuver any fighter in the world. We all watched along with Sandy, who was unable to conceal his enchantment with the very Interceptor that the president had flown to and from Iceland for his meeting with Hitler. The plane climbed steeply with tremendous force before disappearing into the sky. Down the street, the people out walking burst into applause. Somebody shouted, "Hooray for Lindy!" And then they continued on their way. At the Evergreen, my mother and father slept together in one single bed, and Sandy and I in the other. Twin beds were the best Mr. Taylor had been able to locate on such short notice, but after what had happened at the Douglas, nobody complained. Either that the beds weren't exactly made for rest, or that the room was smaller even than our first accommodations, or that the matchbox bathroom, heavily doused though it was with disinfectant, didn't smell right. Especially as we were welcomed graciously when we arrived by a cheerful woman at the front desk, and our suitcases stacked on a dolly by an elderly Negro in a bellhop's uniform, a lanky man the woman called Edward B., who upon unlocking the door to the ground floor room at the nether end of an air shaft, humorously announced, "The Evergreen Hotel welcomes the Roth family to the nation's capital," and ushered us in as though the dimly lit crypt were a boudoir at the Ritz. My brother hadn't stopped staring at Edward B. from the time he loaded our luggage, and the next morning, before anyone else was awake, he stealthily dressed, grabbed his sketchpad, and raced to the lobby to draw him. As it happened, a different Negro bellhop was on duty, one not picturesquely grooved and crannied quite like Edward B., though, from an artistic point of view, no less of a find. Very dark, with strongly African facial features of a kind Sandy had never before gotten to draw from anything other than a photo in a back issue of National Geographic. We spent most of the morning with Mr. Taylor showing us around the Capitol and Congress, and later the Supreme Court and the Library of Congress. Mr. Taylor knew the height of every dome and the dimensions of every lobby and the geographic origins of all the marble flooring and the names of the subjects and the events commemorated in every painting and mural in every government building we entered. "You are something," my father told him. "A small town boy from Indiana, you should be on information, please." After lunch, we drove south along the Potomac into Virginia to tour Mount Vernon. Of course, Richmond, Virginia, Mr. Taylor explained, was the capital of the 11 southern states that left the Union to form the Confederate States of America. Many of the great battles of the Civil War were fought in Virginia. Some 20 miles due west is the Manassas National Battlefield Park. The park includes both battlefields where the Confederates routed the Union forces near the little stream of Bull Run. First, under General P.G.T. Beauregard and General J.E. Johnston in July 1861, and then under General Robert E. Lee and General Stonewall Jackson in August 1862. General Lee was in command of the Army of Virginia, and the president of the Confederacy, who governed from Richmond, was Jefferson Davis, if you remember your history. To the southwest, 125 miles from here, is Appomattox, Virginia. You know what happened in the courthouse there in April 1865. April 9th, to be exact. General Lee surrendered to General U.S. Grant, thus ending the Civil War. And you all know what happened to Lincoln 6 days later. He was shot. "Those dirty dogs," my father said again. "Well, there it is," said Mr. Taylor, just as Washington's house came into view. "Oh, it's so beautiful," my mother said. "Look at the porch. Look at the tall windows. Children, this isn't a replica. This is the real house where George Washington lived, and his wife Martha," Mr. Taylor reminded her, "and his two stepchildren, whom the general doted on." "Did he?" my mother asked. "I didn't know that." "My younger son has Martha Washington on a stamp," she told him. "Show Mr. Taylor your stamp." And I immediately found it, the brown 1938 1.5-cent stamp that pictured the first president's wife in profile, her hair covered with what my mother had identified for me when I first got the stamp as something between a bonnet and a snood. "Yep, that's her, all right," said Mr. Taylor. "And she's also, as I'm sure you know, on a 4-cent 1923 and on an 8-cent 1902. And that 1902 stamp, Mrs. Roth, that is the first stamp ever to show an American woman.
Did you know that? My mother asked me.
Yes, I said, and for me, all the complications of our being a Jewish family in Lindbergh's Washington simply vanished, and I felt the way I felt in school when, at the start of an assembly program, you rose to your feet and sang the national anthem, giving it everything you had. She was a great companion to General Washington, Mr. Taylor told us. Martha Dandridge was her maiden name. The widow of Colonel Daniel Park Custis. Her two children were Patsy and John Park Custis. She brought to her marriage to Washington one of the largest fortunes in Virginia. That's what I always tell my boys, my father said, laughing as we hadn't heard him laugh all day. Marry like President Washington. It's as easy to love him rich as poor. The visit to Mount Vernon was the happiest time we had on that trip. Perhaps because of the beauty of the grounds and the gardens and the trees and of the house, commandingly situated on a bluff overlooking the Potomac. Perhaps because of the unusualness to us of the furnishings, the decoration and the wallpaper. Wallpaper about which Mr. Taylor knew a million things. Perhaps because we got to see from only a few feet away the four-poster bed in which Washington slept, the desk where he wrote, the swords that he wore, and the books that he owned and read. Or perhaps just because we were 15 miles from Washington, D.C., and from Lindbergh's spirit hovering over everything. Mount Vernon was open until 4:30, so we had plenty of time to see all the rooms and the outbuildings, and to wander the grounds, and then to visit the souvenir shop, where I succumbed to the temptation of a letter opener that was a 4-inch pewter replica of a revolutionary musket and bayonet. I bought it with 12 of the 15 cents I'd been saving for our visit the next day to the stamp division of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, while Sandy prudently bought with his savings an illustrated history of Washington's life, a book whose pictures he could use to suggest more portraits for the patriotic series stored in the portfolio under his bed. It was the end of the day, and we were off to have a drink in the cafeteria just as a low-flying plane in the distance came zooming our way. As the roar grew louder, people shouted, "It's the president! It's Lindy!" Men, women, and children all ran out onto the great front lawn and began to wave at the approaching plane, which, as it crossed over the Potomac, tipped its wings. "Hooray!" people shouted. "Hooray for Lindy!" It was the same Lockheed fighter we'd seen in the air over the city the previous afternoon, and we had no choice but to stand there like patriots and watch with the rest of them as it banked and flew back over George Washington's home before it turned to follow the Potomac north. It wasn't him. It was her. Someone claiming to have been able to see into the cockpit had begun to spread word that the pilot of the interceptor was the president's wife. And it could have been true. Lindbergh had taught her to fly when she was still his young bride, and she'd often flown alongside him on his air trips. And so now, people began telling their children that it was Anne Morrow Lindbergh whom they'd just seen flying over Mount Vernon, a historical event they would never forget. By then, her audacity as a pilot of the most advanced American aircraft, combined with her demure manner as a well-bred daughter of the privileged classes, and her literary gifts as the author of 2 published books of lyric poetry, had established her in all the polls as the nation's most admired woman. So, our perfect outing was ruined. And not so much because a recreational flight piloted by one or another of the Lindberghs happened by chance to have passed over our heads for the second day in a row, but because of what the stunt, as my father called it, had inspired in everyone except us. We knew things were bad, my father told the friends he immediately sat down to phone when we got home. But not like this. You had to be there to see what it looked like. They live in a dream, and we live in a nightmare. It was the most eloquent line I'd ever heard him speak, and arguably distinguished by more precision than any ever written by Lindbergh's wife. Mr. Taylor drove us back to the Evergreens so we could wash up and rest, and promptly at 5:45 returned to drive us to the inexpensive cafeteria near the railroad station.
We'd all meet up afterwards, he said, to start the night tour of Washington postponed from the day before. Why don't you come along tonight, my father said to him. Must get lonely eating by yourself all the time. I wouldn't want to invade your privacy, Mr. Roth. Listen here, you're a wonderful guide and we would enjoy it. Treats on us. The cafeteria was even more popular at night than it was during the day. Every chair occupied and customers standing in line, waiting to have their selection spooned out by the three men in white aprons and white caps, who were so busy serving, they didn't have time to stop and dry their perspiring faces. At our table, my mother took solace in resuming her motherly mealtime role. Darling, try not to lower your chin to the plate when you take a bite. And our having Mr. Taylor seated beside us, as if he were a relative or a family friend, though not so novel an adventure as being thrown out of the Douglas Hotel, provided the opportunity to watch someone eat who'd grown up in Indiana. My father was the only one of us paying attention to the other diners, all of them laughing and smoking and diligently digging into the Frenchified evening special, roast beef au jus and pecan pie a la mode, while he sat there fingering his water glass, seemingly trying to figure out how the problems in their lives could be so unlike his own. When he got around to expressing his thoughts, which continued to take precedence over his eating, it wasn't to one of us, but to Mr. Taylor, who was just starting in on a piece of pie topped with American cheese that he'd chosen for dessert.
We are a Jewish family, Mr. Taylor. You know that by now if you didn't already. Because that's the reason we were evicted yesterday. That was a big shock, he said. That's hard to get over just like that. It's a shock because, though it's something that could have happened without this man being president, he is the president, and he is no friend of the Jews. He's the friend of Adolf Hitler.
Herman, my mother whispered, you'll frighten the little one.
The little one knows everything already, he said, and resumed addressing Mr. Taylor. You ever listen to Winchell? Let me quote you Walter Winchell. Was there any more to their diplomatic understanding? Other things they talked about? Other things they agreed on? Did they reach an understanding about America's Jews? And if so, what was it? That's the kind of guts Winchell has. Those are the words he has the guts to speak to the entire country.
Surprisingly, someone had stepped up so close to our table that he was hanging half over it. A heavy-set, mustached, elderly man with a white paper napkin jammed into his belt who seemed inflamed with whatever he had in mind to say. He had been eating at a nearby table, and his companions there were all leaning our way, eager to hear what was coming next.
Hey, what's doing, bud? My father said. Back up, will you?
Winchell is a Jew, the man announced, in the pay of the British government. What happened next was that my father's hands rose violently from the table as though to drive his knife and his fork upward into the stranger's holiday goose of a belly. He hadn't to elaborate further to communicate his abhorrence, and yet the man with the mustache did not budge. The mustache wasn't a dark, close-clipped little square patch like Hitler's, but one conceived of in a less officious, more whimsical spirit. A conspicuously substantial white walrus mustache of the type displayed by President Taft on the light red 1938 50-cent stamp.
If ever there was a case of a loudmouthed Jew with too much power, the stranger said, that is enough, cried Mr. Taylor,
and jumping to his feet placed himself, undersized as he was, between the large figure looming over us and my outraged father, pinned in below by all that ludicrous bulk.
Loudmouthed Jew. And for the second time in less than 48 hours.
Two of the apron men from behind the serving counter had rushed out onto the floor of the cafeteria and taken hold of our assailant from either side. This is not your corner saloon, one of them told him. And don't you forget it, mister. At his table, they pushed him down into his chair. And then the one who chastised him came over to us and said, I want you folks to fill your coffee cups as much as you like. Let me bring the boy some more ice cream. You folks just stay and finish up your supper. I am the owner, my name is Wilbur, and all the desserts you want is on the house. Let's bring you fresh ice water while we're at it. Thank you, my father said, speaking with the eerie impersonality of a machine. Thank you, he repeated. Thank you.
Herman, please, my mother whispered, let's just go.
Absolutely not. No. We're finishing our food. He cleared his throat to continue. We're touring Washington by night. We are not going home till we tour Washington by night. The evening, in other words, was to be seen through to the end without our being frightened away. For Sandy and me, that meant consuming big new dishes of ice cream delivered to our table by one of the countermen. It took a few minutes for the cafeteria to come alive again with the squeaking of chairs and the rattle of cutlery and the light tinkle of plates, if not yet the full dinner-time clamor. "Would you like more coffee?" my father said to my mother. "You heard the owner. He wants to fill your cup." "No," she murmured. "No more." "And you, Mr. Taylor, coffee?" "No, I'm fine." "So," my father said to Mr. Taylor, stiffly, lamely, but beginning again to push back at everything awful that was surging in. "What kind of job did you do before this one? Or have you always been a guide in Washington?" And it was here that we heard once again from the man who'd stepped up to inform us that, like Benedict Arnold before him, Walter Winchell had sold out to the British.
"Oh, don't you worry," he was assuring his friends. "The Jews will find out soon enough."
In all that quiet, there was no mistaking what he'd said, especially as he hadn't bothered to modulate the taunt in any way. Half the diners didn't even look up, pretending to have heard nothing, but more than a few twisted round to look right at the offending objects. I'd seen tarring and feathering only once in a Western movie, but I thought, we are going to be tarred and feathered. Envisioning all our humiliation sticking to the skin like a coat of thick filth that you can never get off. My father was stalled for a moment, having to decide once again whether to attempt to control the event or give in to it.
"I was asking Mr. Taylor," he suddenly said to my mother while taking her hands in both of his,
"about what he did before being a guide." And he looked at her like someone casting a spell, someone whose art is to prevent your will from being free of his and keep you from acting on your own. "Yes," she said, "I heard." And then, her anguish once again filling her with tears, she nonetheless drew herself up erect in her seat and said to Mr. Taylor, "Yes, please tell us." "Keep eating your ice cream, boys," my father said, reaching out and patting our forearms until we looked him right in the eye. "Is it good?" "Yes," we said. "Well, you just keep eating and take your time." He smiled to make us smile and then said to Mr. Taylor, "The job before this one, your old job. What was it you did again, sir?" "I was a college teacher, Mr. Roth."
"Is that right?" my father said.
"Hear that, boys? You're eating your dinner with a college teacher."
"A college history teacher," added Mr. Taylor for the sake of accuracy.
"Should have known," my father admitted.
"Little college in Northwest Indiana," Mr. Taylor told the four of us. "When they shut half the place down in 32, that was it for me."
"And so, what do you do then?" my father asked.
"Well, you can imagine. What with unemployment and all the strikes, I did a little of everything. Harvested mint up in the Indiana mucklands, packed meat for the slaughterhouse in Hammond, packed soap for Cudahy in East Chicago. Worked a year for Real Silk Hosiery Mills in Indianapolis. Even worked a stint at Logansport at the mental hospital there. Worked as an orderly for people suffering mental diseases. Hard times finally washed me up here."
"And what was the name of the college where you taught?" my father asked.
"Wabash."
"Wabash.
Well," said my father, soothed by the very sound of the word,
"everybody has heard of that."
426 students? I'm not so sure they have. What everybody has heard of is something that one of our distinguished graduates once said, though they don't necessarily know him for being a Wabash man. They know him for being U.S. Vice President 1912 to 1920. That's our two-term Vice President, Thomas Riley Marshall.
"Sure," my father said. "Vice President Marshall, the Democratic governor of Indiana, vice president under another great Democrat, Woodrow Wilson. Man of dignity, President Wilson." "It was President Wilson," he said after 2 days of tutelage under Mr. Taylor, himself in the mood now to elucidate,
"who had the courage to appoint Louis D. Brandeis to the Supreme Court. First Jewish member ever of the Supreme Court. You know that, boys?"
We did. It was hardly the first time that he told us. It was only the first time told to us in a booming voice in a cafeteria like this one in Washington, D.C. Sailing on, Mr. Taylor said, And what the vice president said has been famous nationwide ever since. One day, in the United States Senate, while he was presiding over a Senate debate, he said to the senators there, "What this country needs," he said, "is a really good 5-cent cigar." My father laughed. That was indeed a folksy observation that had won the heart of his whole generation, and that even Sandy and I knew through his repeating it to us. So he laughed genially, and then, to further astonish not only his family, but probably everyone in the cafeteria, to whom he already extolled Woodrow Wilson for appointing a Jew to the Supreme Court, he proclaimed, "What this country needs now is a new president." No riot ensued. Nothing. Indeed, by not quitting, he appeared almost to have won the day. "And isn't there a Wabash River?" my father next asked Mr. Taylor. "Longest tributary of the Ohio. Runs 475 miles clear across the state east to west." "And there's a song, too," my father remembered almost dreamily.
"Right you are," replied Mr. Taylor.
"A very famous song. Maybe as famous as Yankee Doodle itself. Written by Paul Dresser in 1897, on the banks of the Wabash, far away."
"Of course," cried my father.
"The favorite song," said Mr. Taylor, "of our Spanish-American war soldiers in 1898, and adopted as the state song of Indiana in 1913, March 4th, to be exact."
Sure, I know that one," my father told him.
"I expect every American does," Mr. Taylor said. And all at once, in a brisk cadence, my father began to sing it, and strongly enough for everyone in the cafeteria to hear. "Through the sycamores, the candlelights are gleaming." "Good," said our guide with admiration. "Very good." And outright bewitched by my father's baritone bravura, the solemn little encyclopedia smiled at last. "My husband," said my dry-eyed mother, "has a lovely singing voice." "That he does," said Mr. Taylor. And though there was no applause, other than from Wilbur back of the serving counter, here we abruptly got up to go. Before we outstayed our tiny triumph, and the man with the presidential mustache went berserk.
Chapter 3, June 1941 to December 1941. Following Christians.
On June 22, 1941, the Hitler-Stalin Non-Aggression Pact, signed 2 years earlier by the two dictators only days before invading and dividing up Poland, was broken without warning when Hitler, having already overrun continental Europe, dared to undertake the conquest of the enormous landmass that stretched from Poland across Asia to the Pacific by staging a massive assault to the east against Stalin's troops. That evening, President Lindbergh addressed the nation from the White House about Hitler's colossal expansion of the war and astonished even my father by his candid praise for the German Führer. "With this act," the president declared, "Adolf Hitler has established himself as the world's greatest safeguard against the spread of communism and its evils. This is not to minimize the effort of Imperial Japan. Dedicated as the Japanese are to modernizing Chiang Kai-shek's corrupt and feudal China, they are equally dedicated to rooting out the fanatical Chinese communist minority, whose aim is to seize control of that vast country and, like the Bolsheviks in Russia, to turn China into a communist prison camp. But it is Hitler to whom the entire world must be grateful tonight for striking at the Soviet Union. If the German army is successful in its struggle against Soviet Bolshevism, and there is every reason to believe that it will be, America will never have to face the threat of a voracious communist state imposing its pernicious system on the rest of the world. I can only hope that the internationalists still serving in the United States Congress recognize that if we had allowed our nation to be dragged into this world war on the side of Great Britain and France, we would now find our great democracy allied with the evil regime of the USSR. Tonight, the German army may well be waging the war that would otherwise have had to be fought by American troops." Our troops were at the ready, however, and would be, the president reminded his countrymen, for a long time to come, because of the peacetime draft established by Congress at his request, 24 months of compulsory military training for 18-year-olds, followed by 8 years on-call in the reserves, which would contribute enormously to fulfilling his dual goal of keeping America out of all foreign wars and of keeping all foreign wars out of America. An independent destiny for America. That was the phrase Lindbergh repeated some 15 times in the State of the Union speech, and again at the close of his address on the night of June 22nd. When I asked my father to explain what the words meant, absorbed by the headlines and weighed down by all my anxious thoughts, I was more and more asking what everything meant. He frowned and said, "It means turning our back on our friends. It means making friends with their enemies. You know what it means, son? It means destroying everything that America stands for." Under the auspices of Just Folks, described by Lindbergh's newly created Office of American Absorption as a volunteer work program for city youth in the traditional ways of Heartland life, my brother left on the last day of June 1941 for a summer apprenticeship with a Kentucky tobacco farmer. Because he'd never been away from home before, and because the family had never lived with such uncertainty before, and because my father objected strenuously to what the OAA's existence implied about our status as citizens, and also because Alvin, already off serving with the Canadian Army, had become a perpetual source of concern, Sandy's was an emotional leave-taking. What had given Sandy strength to resist our parents' arguments against his participating in Just Folks, and planted the idea to apply in the first place, was the support he'd received from my mother's vivid younger sister, Evelyn, now executive assistant to Rabbi Lionel Bengelsdorf, who'd been appointed by the new administration to serve as the first director of the OAA office for the state of New Jersey. The announced purpose of the OAA was to implement programs encouraging America's religious and national minorities to become further incorporated into the larger society. Though by the spring of 1941, the only minority the OAA appeared to take a serious interest in encouraging was ours. It was the intention of Just Folks to remove hundreds of Jewish boys between the ages of 12 and 18 from the cities where they live and attended school and put them to work for 8 weeks as field hands and day laborers with farm families hundreds of miles from their homes. Notices extolling the new summer program had been posted on bulletin boards at Chancellor and at Wequake, the high school just next door, where the student population, like ours, was nearly 100% Jewish. One day in April, a representative from the New Jersey OAA had come to talk to the boys 12 and over about the program's mission, and that evening, Sandy showed up at the dinner table with an application blank that required a parent's signature. "Do you understand what this program is actually trying to do?" my father asked Sandy. "Do you understand why Lindbergh wants to separate boys like you from their families and ship them out to the sticks? Do you have any idea what's behind all this?" "But this doesn't have anything to do with anti-Semitism, if that's what you think. You have one thing on your mind and one thing only. This is just a great opportunity, that's all." "Opportunity for what?" "To live on a farm. To go to Kentucky. To draw all the things there. Tractors, barns, animals. All kinds of animals." "But they're not sending you there all that way to draw animals," my father told him. "They're sending you there to fetch the slops for the animals. They're sending you there to spread manure. You'll be so bushed by the end of the day that you won't be able to stand on your feet, let alone draw a picture of an animal." "And your hands," my mother said. "There's barbed wire on farms. There are machines with sharp blades. You could injure your hands, and then where would you be? You'd never draw again." "I thought you were going to take classes at Arts High this summer. You were going to take drawing with Mr. Leonard." "You can always do that. This is seeing America." The next night, Aunt Evelyn came to dinner, invited by my mother for the hour Sandy was planning to be at a friend's house doing his homework there. That way, he wouldn't be around to witness the argument that was certain to flare up between Aunt Evelyn and my father on the subject of Just Folks. And that did indeed erupt upon her entering the house to announce that she would be taking care of Sandy's application the moment it reached the office. "Don't do us any favors," said my unsmiling father. "You mean to tell me you're not letting him go?" "Why should I? Why would I?" he asked her. "Why on earth wouldn't you?" Aunt Evelyn replied. "Unless you're another Jew afraid of his shadow." Their disagreement only grew more passionate during dinner. my father maintaining that Just Folks was the first step in a Lindbergh plan to separate Jewish children from their parents, to erode the solidarity of the Jewish family, and Aunt Evelyn intimating none too gently that the greatest fear of a Jew like her brother-in-law was that his children might escape winding up as narrow-minded and frightened as he was. Alvin was the renegade on my father's side. Evelyn was the maverick on my mother's, a substitute elementary school teacher in the Newark system who'd been active several years earlier in founding the left-wing, largely Jewish Newark Teachers Union, whose few hundred members were competing with a more staid, apolitical teachers' association to negotiate contracts with the city. Evelyn was just 30 in 1941, and until 2 years before, when my maternal grandmother died of heart failure after a decade as a coronary invalid, it was Evelyn who cared for her in the tiny top-floor apartment of a two-and-a-half family house that mother and daughter shared on Dewey Street, not far from Hawthorne Avenue School, where Evelyn usually subbed. On the days when a neighbor wasn't free to stop by to keep an eye on our grandmother, my mother would take the bus over to Dewey Street and look after her until Evelyn got home from work. And when Evelyn went to New York to see a play with her intellectual friends on a Saturday night, either our grandmother would be driven to our house by my father to spend the evening with us, or my mother would return to Dewey Street to tend to her there. Many nights, Aunt Evelyn never made it home from New York, even when she planned to return before midnight, and so my mother would be forced to spend the night away from her husband and children. And then, there were the afternoons Evelyn didn't get back until hours after school was over because of a long-standing, off-and-on love affair with a substitute teacher from North Newark. Like Evelyn, a forceful union advocate, and unlike Evelyn, married, Italian, and the parent of three children. My mother would always contend that if Evelyn hadn't got waylaid at home for all those years nursing their invalid mother, she would have settled down to marry after getting her teaching certificate and never have ended up falling in and out of unsavory relationships with married men who were her fellow teachers. Her large nose didn't prevent people from calling Aunt Evelyn striking. And it was true, as my mother observed, that when tiny Evelyn walked into her room, a vivacious brunette with a perfect, if miniaturized, womanly silhouette, enormous dark eyes slanted like a cat's, and a crimson lipstick guaranteed to dazzle, everyone turned to look, the women as well as the men. Her hair was lacquered to a metallic luster and pulled back in a chignon. Her eyebrows were dramatically plucked, and when she went off to sub, she donned a brightly colored skirt with matching high-heeled shoes and a broad white belt and a semi-sheer pastel-colored blouse. My father considered her apparel in poor taste for a schoolteacher, and so did the principal at Hawthorne, but my mother, who, wrongly or not, reproached herself for Evelyn's having had to sacrifice her youth caring for their mother, was incapable of judging her sister's boldness harshly. Even when Evelyn resigned from teaching, quit the union, and, seemingly without a qualm, abandoned her political loyalties to work for Rabbi Benkelsdorf and Lindbergh's OAA. It would be several months before it occurred to my parents that Aunt Evelyn was the rabbi's mistress and had been ever since he'd met her at a reception following a speech to the Newark Teachers Union on the classroom development of American ideals. And they realized it only then because on leaving the New Jersey OAA to assume the job of federal director at the national headquarters in Washington, Benkelsdorf announced to the Newark papers news of his engagement at age 63 to his 31-year-old firebrand of an assistant. When he first ran off to fight Hitler, Alvin imagined that the quickest way to see action would be aboard one of the Canadian destroyers that were protecting the merchant marine ships carrying supplies to Great Britain. Stories in the newspaper regularly reported the sinking by German submarines of one or more of the Canadian ships in the North Atlantic, sometimes as close to the mainland as the coastal fishing waters of Newfoundland, an especially ominous development for the British because Canada had become virtually their only source of arms, food, medicine, and machinery once the Lindbergh administration overturned the aid legislation enacted by the Roosevelt Congress. In Montreal, Alvin met a young American defector who told him to forget about the Navy. it was the Canadian commandos who were in the thick of things, carrying out nighttime raids on the Nazi-occupied continent, sabotaging utilities vital to the Germans, blowing up ammunition arsenals, and, alongside British commandos and in concert with underground European resistance movements, destroying dock and shipyard facilities up and down the coastline of Western Europe. When he recounted for Alvin all the many ways the commandos taught you to kill a man, Alvin dropped his original plans and went to join up. Like the rest of the Canadian Armed Forces, the commandos were eager to accept qualified American citizens into their ranks, and so, after 16 weeks of training, Alvin was assigned to an active commando unit and shipped to a secret staging area in the British Isles. And that was when we heard from him, finally, receiving a 6-word letter that read, "Off to fight. See you soon." It was just days after Sandy, all on his own, took the overnight train to Kentucky, that my parents received a second letter. This one not from Alvin, but from the War Department in Ottawa, advising Alvin's designated next of kin that their nephew had been wounded in action and was in a convalescent hospital in Dorset, England. After the dinner dishes were cleared that night, my mother sat back down at the kitchen table with a fountain pen and the box of monogram stationery reserved for important correspondence. My father seated himself across from her, and I stood looking over her shoulder to observe how her cursive script uniformly unfurled because of the handwriting mechanics she employed as a secretary and taught early on to Sandy and me. The third and fourth fingers positioned to support the hand and the forefinger nearer the pen point than the thumb. She spoke each sentence aloud before writing it down in case my father wanted to change or add anything. "Dearest Alvin, this morning we received a letter from the Canadian government telling us that you were wounded in action and that you're in a hospital in England. The letter contained nothing more specific other than a mailing address for you. Right now, we are at the kitchen table, Uncle Herman, Philip, and Aunt Bess. We all want to know everything about your condition. Sandy is away for the summer, but we'll write him about you immediately. Is there any chance you'll be sent back to Canada? If so, we would drive there to see you. In the meantime, we send you our love and hope you will write us from England. Please write or ask someone to write for you. Whatever you want us to do, we will do. Again, we love you and we miss you." To this message, we appended our 3 signatures. It was nearly a month before we got a response. "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Roth, Corporal Alvin Roth received your letter of July 5th. I am the senior nurse on his unit, and I read the letter to him several times to be sure he understood who it was from and what it said. Right now, Corporal Roth is not communicative. He lost his left leg below the knee and was seriously wounded in his right foot. The right foot is healing, and that wound should not leave him impaired. When his left leg is ready, he will be fitted with a prosthesis and taught to walk with it. This is a dark moment for Corporal Roth, but I wish to assure you that in time he should be able to resume his life as a civilian with no significant physical problems. This hospital is limited to amputees and burn cases. I've seen many men undergo the same psychological difficulties as Corporal Roth, but most of them come through, and I strongly believe that Corporal Roth will too. Sincerely, Lieutenant A.F. Cooper." Once a week, Sandy wrote, saying he was fine and reporting how hot it was in Kentucky, and concluding with a sentence about life on the farm. Something like, "There's a bumper crop of blackberries," or "The steer are being driven crazy by flies," or "Today they're cutting alfalfa," or "Topping began," whatever that might mean. Then below his signature, and perhaps to prove to his father that he had stamina enough to do his artwork even after working all day on the farm, he'd sketch a picture of a pig. "This pig," he noted, "weighs over 300 pounds. Or a dog. Susie, Orrin's dog. Her specialty is scaring snakes. Or a lamb. Mr. Mawinney took 30 lambs to the stockyards yesterday. Or of a barn. They just painted this place with creosote P.U. Usually, far more space was taken up by the drawing than by the message, and, to my mother's chagrin, the questions she would raise in her own weekly letter, asking if he needed clothes or medicine or money, rarely got answered. Of course, I knew my mother cared for each of her children with equal devotion, but not till Sandy was gone to Kentucky did I learn how much he meant to her as someone distinct from his little brother. Though she wasn't about to grow despondent over being separated for 8 weeks from a son already 13, all summer long there was an undercurrent of the forlorn, noticeable in certain gestures and facial expressions, particularly at the kitchen table when the fourth chair drawn up for dinner remained empty night after night. Aunt Evelyn was with us when we went to Penn Station to pick Sandy up on the late August Saturday that he arrived back in Newark. She was the last one my father wanted coming along, but just as when, against his own inclinations, he'd eventually allow Sandy to apply for Just Folks and accept the summer job in Kentucky, he had yielded to his sister-in-law's influence over his son to avoid making more difficult a predicament whose ultimate danger still wasn't entirely clear. At the station, Aunt Evelyn was the first of us to recognize Sandy when he stepped from the train onto the platform. Some 10 pounds heavier than when he'd left, and his brown hair blondish from his working in the fields under the summer sun. He'd grown a couple of inches as well, so that his pants were now nowhere near his shoe tops, and altogether, my impression was of my brother in disguise. "Hey, farmer," Aunt Evelyn called, "over here." And Sandy came loping in our direction, swinging his bags at his sides and sporting an outdoorsy new walk to go with the new physique. "Welcome home, stranger," my mother said. And with the air of a young girl, happily threw her arms around his neck, and the words she murmured into his ear, "Was there ever a boy so handsome?" caused him to complain, "Ma, cut it out," which of course handed the rest of the family a big laugh. We all hugged him, and standing beside the train he'd boarded 750 miles away, he flexed his biceps so I could feel them. In the car, when he began answering our questions, we heard how husky his voice had become, and we heard for the first time the drawl and the twang. Aunt Evelyn was triumphant. Sandy talked about the last job he had out in the fields, going around with Orrin, one of the Mawinney sons, picking up the tobacco leaves broken off during harvesting. They were usually the lowest on the plant, Sandy said. They were called flyings, and it so happened that they were top-grade tobacco and fetched the highest price at the market. But the men doing the cutting on a tobacco patch of 25 acres can't bother about the leaves on the ground, he told us, as they had to cut some 3,000 sticks of tobacco a day in order to get everything housed in the curing barn in 2 weeks. "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa. What's a stick, dear?" Aunt Evelyn asked. And gladly he obliged her with the lengthiest possible explanation. "And so, what's a curing barn?" she asked. "What's topping? What's suckering? What's worming?" And the more questions Aunt Evelyn came up with, the more authoritative Sandy became, so that even when we got to Summit Avenue and my father pulled the car into the alleyway, he was still going on about raising tobacco as though expecting us all to head right for the backyard and start preparing the weedy patch of dirt next to the garbage cans for Newark's first crop ever of white burley. "It's the sweetened burley in Lucky's," he informed us, "that gives him the taste." And meanwhile, I was itching to feel his biceps again, which to me were no less extraordinary than the regional accent. If that's what it was, he said, "Can't for can't, remember for remember, and fire for fire, and again for again, and a walking and a talking for walking and talking." And whatever you wanted to call that concoction of English, it wasn't what we natives of New Jersey spoke. Aunt Evelyn was triumphant, but my father was stymied, said almost nothing, and at the dinner table that evening looked especially glum when Sandy got around to reporting on what a paragon Mr. Mawinney was. First off, Mr. Mawinney had graduated from the College of Agriculture at the University of Kentucky, while my father, like most other Newark slum children before the World War, hadn't been educated beyond the 8th grade. Mr. Mawinney owned not just one farm, but three. the lesser two rented to tenants. Land that had been in his family going back nearly to the days of Daniel Boone, and my father owned nothing more impressive than a 6-year-old car. Mr. Mawinney could saddle a horse, drive a tractor, operate a thresher, ride a fertilizer drill, work a field as easily with a team of mules as with a team of oxen. He could rotate crops and manage hired men, both white and Negro. He could repair tools, sharpen plow points and mowers, put up fences, string barbed wire, raise chickens, dip sheep, dehorn cattle, slaughter pigs, smoke bacon, sugar cure ham. And he raised watermelons that were the sweetest and juiciest Sandy had ever eaten. By cultivating tobacco, corn, and potatoes, Mr. Mawinney was able to make a living right out of the earth. And then, at Sunday dinner, where the 6-foot-3-inch, 230-pound farmer consumed more fried chicken with cream gravy than everyone else at the table combined, eat only food that he himself had raised, and all my father could do was sell insurance. It went without saying that Mr. Mawinney was a Christian, a long-standing member of the great overpowering majority that fought the revolution and founded the nation and conquered the wilderness and subjugated the Indian and enslaved the Negro and emancipated the Negro and segregated the Negro, one of the good, clean, hard-working Christian millions who settled the frontier, tilled the farms, built the cities, governed the states, sat in Congress, occupied the White House, amassed the wealth, possessed the land, owned the steel mills and the ball clubs and the railroads and the banks, even owned and oversaw the language. One of those unassailable Nordic and Anglo-Saxon Protestants who ran America and would always run it. Generals, dignitaries, magnates, tycoons, the men who laid down the law and called the shots and read the riot act when they chose to, while my father, of course, was only a Jew. Sandy got the news about Alvin once Aunt Evelyn had gone home. My father was at the kitchen table working on his account books, preparatory to going out to make his evening collections, and my mother was in the cellar with Sandy, sorting through the clothes he'd brought back from Kentucky, deciding what to repair, what to throw out, before putting everything else in the wash tub. My mother always did immediately whatever had to be done, and she was set on disposing of his dirty clothes before she went to bed. I was down there with them, unable to let my brother out of my sight. He'd always known everything I didn't know, and he'd come back from Kentucky knowing still more. "I have to tell you about Alvin," my mother said to him. "I didn't want to write because, well, I didn't want to shock you, dear." Here, having gathered herself together to make certain she wouldn't cry, she said in a low voice, "Alvin was wounded. He's in a hospital in England. He's there recovering from his wounds." Astonished, Sandy asked, "Who wounded him?" As though she were reporting an occurrence in our neighborhood rather than in Nazi-occupied Europe, where people were being maimed, wounded, and killed all the time. "We don't know any details," my mother said. "But it wasn't a superficial wound. I have to tell you something very sad, Sanford." And despite her attempt to keep everyone's courage up, her voice began to waver when she said, "Alvin's lost a leg." A leg? There aren't many words less abstruse than leg, but it took some doing for him to comprehend it. "Yes. According to a letter we got from one of his nurses, his left leg, below the knee." As if it might somehow soothe him, she added, "If you'd like to read it, the letter's upstairs." "But how will he walk?" "They're going to fit him with an artificial leg." "But I don't understand who wounded him. How did he get wounded?" "Well, they were there to fight the Germans," she said, "so it must have been one of them." Still, half staving off what was half sinking in, Sandy asked, "Which leg?" As tenderly as she could, she repeated, "The left." "The whole leg? The whole thing?" "No, no, no," she rushed to reassure him. "I told you, dear, below the knee." Suddenly, Sandy began to cry. and because he was so much bigger across the shoulders and through the chest and around the wrist than he'd been just last spring, because his arms were now brawny like a man's rather than stringy like a child's, I was so startled to see tears running down his deeply tanned face that I started crying too. "Dear, it's awful," my mother said, "but Alvin is not dead. He's still alive, and now at least he's out of the war."
"What?" Sandy erupted. "Did you hear what you just said to me?"
"What do you mean?" she asked.
"Didn't you hear yourself? You said he's out of the war." "And he is, absolutely. And because he is, he'll now come home before anything more can possibly happen." "But why was he even in the war, Ma?"
Because of Dad," Sandy shouted.
"Dear, no, this isn't true."
And her hand flew up to cover her mouth, as though it were she who had spoken those unpardonable words.
"That is not so," she objected. "Alvin went off to Canada without telling us. He ran away on that Friday night. You remember how terrible it was? Nobody wanted Alvin to go to war. He just went, on his own.
But Dad wants the whole country to go to war."
"Well, doesn't he? Isn't that why he voted for Roosevelt?"
"Lower your voice, please.
First you say, 'Thank God that Alvin is out of the war.'"
"Lower your voice." And the tension of the day now so overwhelmed her that she lost her temper, and to the boy she had so painfully missed all summer long, she snapped,
"You don't know what you're talking about."
"But you won't listen," he shouted.
"If it wasn't for President Lindbergh..."
That name again.
"I would rather have heard a bomb go off than to have to hear one more time the name that was tormenting us all."
Just then, my father appeared in the dim light of the landing at the top of the cellar stairs. It was probably a good thing that from where we were standing by the deep laundry sink, all we could see of him were trousers and shoes.
"He's upset about Alvin," my mother said, looking up to explain what the shouting was about. "I made a mistake."
To Sandy, she said, "I should never have told you tonight. It's not easy for a boy to come home from a big experience like that. It's never easy to go from one place to another. And anyway, you're so tired." And then, helpless, giving herself up to her own exhaustion, she said, "The two of you, both of you, go upstairs now so I can do the wash." And so we turned to mount the stairs and found, fortunately, that my father had already disappeared from the landing and was off in the car to make his evening collections. In bed, 1 hour later, the lights are out all over the house. We whisper,
"Did you really have a good time?"
"I had a great time."
"What made it so great?"
"Being on a farm is great. You get to get up early in the morning and you're outside all day and there are all these animals. I drew a lot of animals. I'll show you my drawings. And we had ice cream every night. Mrs. Mawinney makes it herself. There's fresh milk there."
"All milk is fresh."
"No, we got it right from the cow. It was still warm. We put it on the stove and we'd boil it and just take the cream off the top and then we'd drink it.
You couldn't get sick from it. That's why you boil it.
But you don't just drink it right out of the cow."
"I tried that once, but it doesn't taste so good. It's so creamy."
"Did you milk a cow?"
"Oren showed me how to do it. It's hard to do. Oren would squirt it, and the cats would come around and they'd try to catch the milk."
"Did you have any friends?"
"Well, Oren's my best friend."
"Oren Mawinney?"
"Yeah, he's my age. He goes to school there. He works on the farm. He gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning. He does chores. It's not like us. He goes to school on the bus. It's about 45 minutes on the bus. And then he comes back in the evening and he does some more chores and he does his homework and he goes to bed. He gets up at 4 o'clock the next morning. It's hard work to be a farmer's son. But they're rich, aren't they? They're pretty rich."
"How come you talk like that now?"
"Why shouldn't I? That's the way they talk in Kentucky. You should hear Mrs. Mawinney. She's from Georgia. She makes pancakes for breakfast every morning with bacon. Mr. Mawinney smokes his own bacon in a smokehouse. He knows how to."
"You ate bacon every morning?"
"Every morning.
It's delicious. And on Sundays, when we got up, we had pancakes, bacon, and eggs from their own chickens. The eggs, they're almost red in the middle. They're so fresh. You go and take them from the chickens and bring them in, and you eat them right there. Did you eat ham? We had ham for dinner about 2 times a week. Mr. Mawinney makes his own ham. He has a special family recipe. He says if a ham isn't hung up to be aged for a year, he doesn't want to eat it. Did he eat sausage? Yeah, he makes the sausage too. They grind it in a sausage grinder. We had sausage sometimes instead of bacon. It's good. Pork chops. Oh, they're good too. They're great. I don't really know why we don't eat it. Because it's stuffed from a pig. So what? Why do you think farmers raise pigs? For people to look at them? It's like anything else you eat. You just eat it, and it's really good. You're going to keep eating it now? Sure. It was really hot there, though, huh? During the day. But we'd come in at lunchtime, and we'd have tomato and mayonnaise sandwiches with lemonade, with lots of lemonade. We'd rest inside, and then we'd go back out into the fields and do whatever we had to do. Weeding. Weed all afternoon. Weed the corn. Weed the tobacco. We had a vegetable garden, me and Oren, and we'd weed that. We'd work with the hired hands. And there were some Negroes, day laborers. And there's one Negro, Randolph, who is a tenant, and he rose from hired hand. He's a grade A farmer, Mr. Mawinney says. Can you understand when the Negroes talk? Sure. Can you imitate one? They say bacca for tobacco. They say, I clare this and I clare that, but they don't talk much. Mostly they work. At hog killing time, Mr. Mawinney has Cleet and Old Henry who gut the hogs. They're Negroes, they're brothers, and they take the intestines home and eat them fried. Chitterlings. Would you eat that? Do I look like a Negro? Mr. Mawinney says Negroes are starting to move away from the farm because they think they can earn more money in the city. Sometimes Old Henry got arrested on Saturday nights for drinking. Mr. Mawinney pays the fine to get him out because he needs them on Monday. Do they have shoes? Some. The kids are barefoot. The Mawinneys give them their clothes when they're done with them, but they were happy. Anybody say anything about anti-Semitism? They don't even think about it, Philip. I was the first Jew they ever met. They told me that. But they never said anything mean. It's Kentucky. People there are really friendly. So, are you glad to be home? Sort of. I don't know. You gonna go back next year? Sure. What if Mom and Dad won't let you? I'll go anyway.
Seemingly, as a direct consequence of Sandy's having eaten bacon, ham, pork chops, and sausage, there was no containing the transformation of our lives. Rabbi Bengelsdorf was coming to dinner. Aunt Evelyn was bringing him.
Why, yes, my father said to my mother.
Dinner was over. Sandy was on his bed writing to Oren Mawinney, and I was alone with them in the living room, intent on seeing how my father was going to take the news now that everything around us was moving at once. She is my sister, said my mother, a touch belligerently. He is her boss. I can't tell her no.
I can, he said. You'll do nothing of the sort.
Then explain again why we deserve this great honor. The big shot has nothing more pressing than to come here.
Evelyn wants him to meet your son. That's ridiculous.
Your sister has always been ridiculous. My son is in the 8th grade at Chancellor Avenue School. He spent the summer pulling weeds. This is all ridiculous, Herman. They're coming on Thursday night, and we're going to make them welcome. You may hate him, but he's not nobody.
I know that, he said impatiently.
That's why I hate him.
When he walked about the house now, a copy of PM was constantly in his hands, either rolled up like a weapon, as though he were preparing, if called upon, to go to war himself, or turned back to a page where there was something he wanted to read aloud to my mother. He was perplexed on this particular evening as to why the Germans continued to advance so easily into Russia.
And so, rattling the paper in exasperation, he all at once exclaimed, "Why don't those Russians fight? They have planes. Why don't they use them? Why doesn't anybody over there put up a fight? Hitler walks into a country, crosses the border, and walks right in, and bingo, it's his. England," he announced, "is the only country in Europe to stand up to that dog. He pounds away at those English cities every single night, and they just come back and keep on fighting him with the RAF. Thank God for the men of the RAF. "When is Hitler going to invade England?" I asked him. "Why doesn't he invade England now?" That was part of the deal he made with Mr. Lindbergh up in Iceland. "Lindbergh wants to be the savior of mankind," my father explained to me, "and negotiate the peace that ends the war, and so after Hitler takes Russia, and after he takes the Middle East, and after he takes everything else he could possibly want, Lindbergh will call a phony peace conference, the kind that's right up the Germans' alley. The Germans will be there, and the price for world peace, and no German invasion of Great Britain, will be installing in England an English fascist government, putting a fascist prime minister in Downing Street, and when the English say no, then Hitler will invade, and all with the consent of our president, the peacemaker." "Is that what Walter Winchell says?" I asked, thinking that all he had explained to me was just too smart for him. "That's what I say," he told me, and probably that was true. Thank God for Walter Winchell. Without him, we'd be lost. He's the last person left on the radio to speak out against these dirty dogs. It's disgusting. It's worse than disgusting. Slowly but surely, there's nobody in America willing to speak out against Lindbergh's kissing Hitler's behind. "What about the Democrats?" I asked. "Son, don't ask me about the Democrats. I'm angry enough as it is." My mother had me help her set the table in the dining room on Thursday evening, and then sent me to my bedroom to change into my good clothes. Aunt Evelyn and Rabbi Bengelsdorf were to arrive at 7, 45 minutes later than we would ordinarily have finished eating in the kitchen, but 7 was the earliest the rabbi could manage to get to our house because of all his official duties. This was the very traitor whom my father, usually so respectful of the Jewish clergy, had accused aloud of making a stupid, lying speech in behalf of Mr. Lindbergh at Madison Square Garden. The Jewish fake, according to Alvin, who guaranteed Roosevelt's defeat by koshering Lindbergh for the Goyim. And so it was puzzling to witness the lengths to which we were going to feed him. I was myself instructed beforehand not to use the fresh towels in the bathroom or to go anywhere near my father's armchair, which was for the rabbi to occupy before we ate dinner. First, we all sat stiffly in the living room while my father offered the rabbi a highball, or, if he preferred, a shot of schnapps, both of which Bengelsdorf declined in favor of a glass of tap water. "Newark has the best drinking water in the world," the rabbi said, and said it, as he would say everything, with deep consideration. Graciously, he received the glass, on a coaster, from my mother, whom I could still recall back in October running from the radio in order not to have to hear him praise Lindbergh. "You have a most agreeable house," he said to her. "Everything in its place, and everything placed perfectly. It bespeaks the love of order, which I myself share. I see you have a penchant for the color green." "Forest green," said my mother, trying to smile and trying to please, but speaking with difficulty and unable as yet to look his way. "You should take great pride in your lovely home. I am honored to be a guest here." The rabbi was quite tall, built on the order of Lindbergh, a thin, bald-headed man in a dark three-piece suit and gleaming black shoes whose erect posture alone seemed to me to express an allegiance to mankind's highest ideals. From the mellifluous southern accent I'd heard on the radio, I had envisioned somebody looking far less severe, but just his eyeglasses were intimidating, in part because they were the owlish oval spectacles that pinched the nose to stay on the face, like the ones that Roosevelt wore, and in part because the very fact that he wore them and examined you through them microscopically made it clear that he was not a man with whom to disagree. Yet, when he spoke, his tone was warm, friendly, even confiding. I kept waiting for him to treat us with contempt or order us around, but all he did was to talk in that accent, which wasn't at all like Sandy's, and so softly that at times you had to hold your breath to hear how learned he was.
"And you must be the boy," he said to Sandy, who made us all so proud.
"I'm Sandy, sir," Sandy replied, flushing furiously. It was, to my mind, a brilliant retort to a question that another successful boy, trying to meet the sanctioned standard of modesty, might not have been able to handle with such dispatch. No, nothing could now undo Sandy. Not with those muscles, and that sun-bleached hair, and the abundance of pig he'd stashed away without asking permission of anyone.
"And what was it like," the rabbi asked, "to work there in the Kentucky fields under the burning sun?"
He said work for work, and burning for burning, and there for there, and pronounced Kentucky as it was spelled, and not as Sandy now did, as though the first three letters were K-I-N.
"I learned a lot, sir. I learned a lot about my country."
Aunt Evelyn visibly approved, as well she might have, since on the phone the evening before, she fitted him out with the answer to just such a question.
Since she had always to be superior to my father, there could be no greater delight than to shape the existence of his oldest son right in front of his nose.
"You were on a tobacco farm, your Aunt Evelyn tells me."
"Yes, sir. White, burly tobacco."
"Did you know, Sandy, that tobacco was the economic foundation of the first permanent English settlement in America, at Jamestown, Virginia?"
"I didn't," he admitted, but added, "though I'm not surprised to hear it," and in a flash, the worst was over.
"Many mishaps beset the Jamestown pioneers," the rabbi told him,
"but what saved them from starvation and saved the settlement from extinction was the cultivation of tobacco. Think of it. Without tobacco, the first representative government in the New World would never have met at Jamestown as it did in 1619. Without tobacco, the Jamestown colony would have collapsed, the colonization of Virginia would have failed, and the first families of Virginia, whose wealth derived from their tobacco plantations, would themselves have never come to prominence. And when you remember that the first families of Virginia were the forebears of the Virginia statesmen who were our country's founding fathers, you appreciate tobacco's vital importance to the history of our republic."
"You do," Sandy answered.
"I myself," said the rabbi, "was born in the American South. I was born 14 years after the tragedy of the Civil War. My father was a young man, fought for the Confederacy. His father came from Germany to settle in South Carolina in 1850. He was a peddler, he had a horse with a wagon, and he wore a long beard, and he sold to the Negroes and to the white people both."
"Did you ever hear of Judah Benjamin?" the rabbi asked Sandy.
"No, sir." But again, he quickly righted himself, this time by replying, "May I ask who he was?" "Well, he was a Jew, and second only to Jefferson Davis in the government of the Confederacy. He was a Jewish lawyer, who served Davis as Attorney General, as Secretary of War, and as Secretary of State. Prior to the secession of the South, he had served in the U.S. Senate as one of South Carolina's two senators. The cause for which the South went to war was neither legal nor moral in my judgment, yet I have always held Judah Benjamin in the highest regard. A Jew was a rarity in America in those days. In the North, no less than the South, but don't think there wasn't anti-Semitism to contend with back then. Nonetheless, Judah Benjamin came close to the very pinnacle of political success in the Confederate government. After the war was lost, he moved abroad to become a distinguished lawyer in England. Here, my mother removed herself to the kitchen, purportedly to check on the dinner, and Aunt Evelyn said to Sandy, "Maybe this is a good time for the rabbi to see the drawings you made on the farm." Sandy got up and carried over to the rabbi's chair the several sketchbooks that he'd filled with drawings during the summer and that he'd been holding in his lap since we all gathered in the living room. The rabbi took one of the books and began slowly turning the pages. Tell the rabbi a little something about each picture, Aunt Evelyn suggested. That's the barn, Sandy said. That's where they hang the tobacco to cure after they harvest it. Well, that is a barn, all right. And a beautifully drawn barn. I very much like the pattern of light and dark. You're very talented, Sanford. And that's a tobacco plant growing. That's what they look like, see? It's shaped like a triangle. The big, that one's still got the blossom on top. It's before they top it. And this tobacco plant, the rabbi said, turning to a new page with the bag on top, that is something I've never seen before. That's how they get the seed. That's a seed plant. They cover the blossom with a paper bag and tie it tight. It keeps the blossom the way they want it. Very, very good, the rabbi said. It isn't easy to draw a plant accurately and still make it into a work of art. Look how you've shadowed the undersides of the leaves. Very good, indeed. And that's a plow, of course, Sandy said. And that's a hoe. That's a hand hoe to do your weeding with, though you can also use just your hands. And did you weed much? The rabbi asked teasingly. Oh, boy, Sandy said, and Rabbi Bengelsdorf smiled, looking not at all like a frightening figure. And that's just the dog, Sandy went on. Orange dog. She's sleeping. And that's one of the Negroes, old Henry, and those are his hands. I thought they had character. And who's this? That's old Henry's brother. That's Cleet. I like the way you rendered him. How weary the man looks, slouching like that. I know those Negroes. I grew up with them. And I respect them. And this, what would this be? The rabbi asked. Here, with the bellows. Well, a person's inside. That's how he sprays against tobacco worms. He has to dress like that from head to foot with big gloves and heavy clothes all buttoned up so he doesn't get burned. When he squirts the insecticide out through the bellows, he can burn himself with it. It's green, the dust, and when he's finished, his clothes are covered with it. I tried to get the look of the dust. I tried to make it lighter where the dust is, but I don't think it came out right. Well, I'm sure, said the rabbi, that it's hard to draw dust. And began to progress a little more rapidly through the remaining pages until he came to the end and closed the book. Kentucky was an experience that wasn't wasted on you, was it, young man? I loved it, Sandy replied, and my father, who had been silent and unmoving on the sofa since yielding the rabbi his favorite chair, got up and said, I have to help Bess, the way he might have said, I'm now going to jump out the window and kill myself. The Jews of America, the rabbi told us at dinner, are unlike any other community of Jews in the history of the world. They have the greatest opportunity accorded to our people in modern times. The Jews of America can participate fully in the national life of their country. They need no longer dwell apart, a pariah community separated from the rest. All that is required is the courage that your son Sandy displayed by going on his own into the unknown of Kentucky to work for the summer as a farmhand there. I believe that Sandy and the other Jewish boys like him in the Just Folks program should serve as models not only for every Jewish child growing up in this country, but for every Jewish adult. And this is not merely a dream of mine. It is the dream of President Lindbergh. Our ordeal had suddenly taken the worst possible turn. I'd not forgotten how in Washington my father had stood up to the hotel manager and the bullying policeman, and so, now that Lindbergh's name had been spoken with deference in his house, I thought the moment had come when he would stand up to Bengelsdorf. But a rabbi was a rabbi, and he didn't. My mother and Aunt Evelyn served the meal. Three courses, followed by a marble cake freshly baked in our oven that afternoon. We ate off the good dishes with the good silverware, and in the dining room, no less, where we had our best rug and our best furniture and our best linens, and where we ourselves ate only on special occasions. From my side of the table, you could see the photographic portraits of the family dead arranged atop the brake front that was our memorial shrine. Framed there were two grandfathers, our maternal grandmother, a maternal aunt, and two uncles. One of them, Uncle Jack, Alvin's father and my father's beloved older brother. In the aftermath of Rabbi Bengelsdorf's invoking Lindbergh's name, I was more confused than ever. A rabbi was a rabbi, but Alvin, meanwhile, was in a Canadian Army hospital in Montreal learning to walk on an artificial left leg after having lost his own left leg battling Hitler. And in my own house, where I was supposed to wear anything except my good clothes, I had to put on my one tie and my one jacket to impress the very rabbi who helped to elect the president whose friend was Hitler. How could I not be confused when our disgrace and our glory were one and the same? Something essential had been destroyed and lost. We were being coerced to be other than the Americans we were, and yet by the light of the cut glass chandelier, amid the weighty, dark-stained suite of dining room furniture, we were eating my mother's pot roast in the company of the first famous visitor we had ever entertained. To further confound me and make me pay the full price for my thoughts, Bengelsdorf began all at once to speak about Alvin, whom he learned about from Aunt Evelyn. "I am saddened by the casualty in your family. My heart goes out to all of you. Evelyn tells me that when your nephew is released from the hospital, he will come to convalesce with you all. I'm sure you know the mental anguish that such a wound can provoke in someone still in the flower of his youth. It will require all the love and patience you can muster to bring him to where he can again resume a useful life. His story is particularly tragic because there was no necessity whatsoever for his having crossed over to Canada to join their armed forces. Alvin Roth was born a citizen of the United States, and the United States is not at war with anyone, has no intention of going to war with anyone, and doesn't require the sacrifice of life or limb in warfare from a single one of its young men. Some of us have gone to great lengths to make this so. I have encountered considerable hostility from members of the Jewish community for allying myself in the 1940 election with the Lindbergh campaign. But I have been sustained by my abhorrence of war. It is terrible enough that young Alvin should have lost his leg in a battle on the European continent, having nothing to do with the security of America or the well-being of Americans. On he went, more or less repeating what he said at Madison Square Garden in support of America's remaining neutral, but my focus now was only on Alvin. He was coming to stay with us? I looked at my mother. She told us nothing about it. When would he arrive? Where would he sleep? It was bad enough, as my mother had said in Washington, that we weren't living in a normal country. Now, we would never again be living in a normal house. A life, even more suffering, was taking shape around me, and I wanted to scream, "No! Alvin can't stay here! He has only one leg!" I was so upset that it was a while before I realized that the dining room reign of decorum had ended, and my father was no longer allowing himself to be shoved aside. Somehow, he had managed at last to overturn the obstacles posed by Bengelsdorf's credentials and by his own insufficiencies. He had ceased being intimidated by the rabbinical grandeur, and urged on by his irrepressible sense of an impending disaster and violently irritated by the condescension, he was letting Bengelsdorf have it, pince-nez and all. "Hitler," I heard him saying, "Hitler is not business as usual, Rabbi. This madman is not making a war from 1,000 years ago. He is making a war such as no one has ever seen on this planet. He has conquered Europe. He is at war with Russia every night. He bombs London into rubble and kills hundreds of innocent British civilians. He is the worst anti-Semite in history. And yet, his great friend, our president, takes him at his word when Hitler tells him that they have an understanding. Hitler had an understanding with the Russians. Did he keep it?
He had an understanding with Chamberlain. Did he keep it? Hitler's goal is to conquer the world, and that includes the United States of America. And since everywhere he goes, he shoots the Jews, when the time is right, he'll come and shoot the Jews here. And what will our president do then? Protect us? Defend us? Our president will not lift a finger. That is the understanding that they reached at Iceland, and any adult who thinks otherwise is crazy.
Rabbi Bengelsdorf showed no impatience with my father, but listened respectfully, as if in sympathy with at least some of what he was hearing. Only Sandy seemed to be having trouble keeping his feelings to himself, and when our father referred scornfully to Lindbergh as our president, he turned to me and made a face that revealed how far he'd spun out of the family orbit merely by making the ordinary American's adjustment to the new administration. My mother was seated to my father's right, and when he had finished, gripped his hand in hers, though to communicate how proud she was of him or to signal him to be still wasn't clear. As for Aunt Evelyn, she took all her cues from the rabbi, concealing her thoughts behind a mask of benign sufferance, while her shallow brother-in-law dared to oppose with his piddling vocabulary a scholar who could talk in 10 languages. Bengelsdorf did not immediately respond, but instead created a portentous interval in which quietly to insert his rejoinder. I was at the White House talking to the president just yesterday morning. Here he sipped from his glass of water, allowing time for us to regain self-possession. I was congratulating him, he continued, on the significant inroad he had made into allaying the Jewish suspiciousness that dated back to his trips to Germany in the late 30s, when he was secretly taking the measure of the German Air Force for the U.S. government. I informed him that any number of my own congregants who had voted for Roosevelt were now his strong supporters, grateful that he had established our neutrality and spared our country the agonies of yet another great war. I told him that just folks and programs like it were beginning to convince the Jews of America that he is anything but their enemy. Admittedly, before his becoming president, he at times made public statements grounded in anti-Semitic cliches, but he spoke from ignorance then, and admits as much today. I am pleased to tell you that it took no more than 2 or 3 sessions alone with the president to get him to relinquish his misconceptions and to appreciate the manifold nature of Jewish life in America. This is not an evil man, not in any way. This is a man of enormous native intelligence and great probity, who is rightly celebrated for his personal courage, and who wants now to enlist my aid to help him raise those barriers of ignorance that continue to separate Christian from Jew, and Jew from Christian. Because there is ignorance as well among Jews. Unfortunately, many of whom persist in thinking of President Lindbergh as an American Hitler, when they know full well that he is not a dictator who attained power in a putsch, but a democratic leader who came to office through a landslide victory in a fair and free election, and who has exhibited not a single inclination toward authoritarian rule. He does not glorify the state at the expense of the individual, but, to the contrary, encourages entrepreneurial individualism and a free enterprise system unencumbered by interference from the federal government.